Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great-tasting, high-quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, here on Heritage Radio Network. And it is a hot summer day here in New York City. But that's all right, because we are going to be talking about something that could really hold the heat. What would that be? How about cast iron? And here to talk about cast iron, and particularly cast iron cookware is what we're talking about, is Joel Schiff and Stacy Harwood. Joel is probably one of the foremost collectors of cast iron cookware in the U.S., and he, in fact, if I can just read a quote from the Wall Street Journal, who wrote a wonderful article on Joel and his collection, says that one of his persistent desires is to establish the Museum of the Hearth and Kitchen. The idea is to trace the history of pre-modern cooking from Stone Age until about 1950, or I guess maybe we could expand that a little further, with exhibits, reenactments, and an on-site restaurant where chefs would prepare meals using bygone techniques. Well, Joel is indeed, he has probably over, I would say by now, 8 to 10,000 pieces. He counted it at 7,000 at one time. His apartment, there's a picture of him in his apartment, and it is just crammed to the ceiling with cast iron pieces. Someone who has seen that collection is with us too, my friend, Stacy Harwood. Stacy is a writer. She's a poet and a bit of a culinary historian as well, and a blogger on the blog BestAmericanPoetry.com. And Stacy has an article coming up soon in Savour on cast iron and collectors. Welcome to both of you. Glad to have you here.
Great to be here, Linda.
Thank you so much.
Now, let's talk. Talking about cast iron, you know, a lot of people, if you say if you say cast iron cookware, people immediately think of their grandmother's crusty, old, greasy, disgusting-looking black skillet that they probably toss aside. And a lot of people call it heirloom cookware. But now all of a sudden it's the rage again, but it does have probably some of the longest history of cookware that we know of. And I would like to jump right into that with you, Joel. And can you tell us where, when and where we pretty much trace the first cast iron cookware?
Well, not surprisingly, since so much started in China, there seems to be some indication from one of the articles in Scientific American that there was cast iron cookware probably around 600 BC in China. Now, we normally think of pig iron, which is basically the melting of the earth to get the iron, as sort of a preliminary stock material. But actually, pig iron is a form of cast iron. It just has a lot of impurities. A lot of carbon content, so it's very, very brittle. It's called white cast iron. And they were actually making it into things, and very likely into cookware in China in 600 BC.
Well, now, how did they make, you know, the furnaces, the fires, hot enough to be able to melt this down, this ore down to
cast it? That's exactly the question. The heats of the furnaces are what govern a lot of things, including cooking. Mm-hmm. But the... as with when you put antifreeze into your car, when you have things that are mixtures, it depresses the melting point, so you can melt it at a lower temperature, although it raises the boiling point. So when you have pure iron, it has a huge temperature. So to melt pure iron is somewhere close to 3,000 degrees. But when you have it mixed in earth with lots of other things to make a mixture in which iron gets melted, it's probably only a little bit above the melting point of copper and brass and stuff, like maybe about 500 degrees. So you're talking about having an ordinary hearth fire with a bellows. And so that's what they would did. And they had stacked casting techniques. So they would have the iron melt, pour it into the top, and it would drip down through all the different molds, which was not a technique that seems to have been used anyplace else in the world that I know of.
While it was continually being heated in the fires.
Yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, that was a difficult process. And getting those furnaces, that pretty much delayed the actual manufacturer process of mass manufacturing of cast iron, I would imagine.
Well, having it in the low, because anything that produces iron has to get the iron from someplace, and so you either get it from meteoric iron or else you have to melt it like that. And all throughout Europe and the Levant, including, if you ever heard the word serendipity, which means something that's sort of like by guess and by golly or luck or something, that comes from the island of Serendip, which was actually Ceylon, where they have actually traced a special kind of an oven that made use of the monsoon, in that it had a kind of an airplane foil shape over the top of it. So when the monsoon ran over the top of the oven, it pulled air through holes in the side of the oven. It seems the only place where they actually had side ovens, and they produced a lot of the iron that would later went to Damascus, that was made into Damascus steel, just like this other kind with pig iron. You have all the major manufactories that had steel, whether it was Toledo, Sheffield, or any of the others in Europe. Which starts maybe in the 1200s, practically 1,000 years later than China, all have from the heating of pig iron. But this one here was kind of an airplane-type form. So it's ancient, and steel we normally think of as being something that is very rarefied. Actually, you can make steel by either having wrought iron and adding carbon to it by folding and everything. For those who are into armaments and swords and things like that, you have the folding and then beating and folding again. You're actually adding carbon into it. Or you can have things like in the modern Bessemer process, where you start with pig iron, which has a lot of the carbon, and you blow oxygen through it, which makes it into carbon dioxide and gets rid of the carbon in it. So you can either go from either direction, from pig iron down to steel or wrought iron up to steel. But steel was arguably, aside from pig iron, was produced before large amounts of cast iron were produced.
Interesting. Well, you got into collecting cast iron by a very interesting little story, if you would share that, because we are experiencing a very hot day here today. But you had a hotter tale.
Yes, unfortunately, I was cleaning off some paint in my barge where I lived during the 60s as part of a barge counterculture community. And unfortunately, it got into some of the insulation and started a fire that was out of control in about 1 minute. So I had to get out along with everybody else that was in the barge community. But the only thing that survived the fire was my cast iron cookware. My leg burned, my crutches burned, a whole bunch of other stuff. The only thing that survived the fire. And then one of the guys who was a respite for anybody who needed something in the barge community, but he was often into his cups when he came back from the gin mill on his hands and knees, fell in and passed away after nobody was there. And so we all had this huge wake for him, and we all took some of his things because he had no relatives, and I got two of his pots. And it was
so the cast iron really could take the. I mean, if anyone has ever seen pictures, or in fact has visited, you know, blast furnaces in the steel, you know, steel mills like in Bethlehem, you know, Pennsylvania or anything, you know the intensity of that.
Oh, it can
heat.
Take heat.
Yeah, and cast iron can take the heat. Well, now, Stacy, you did a lot of research on people who collect cast iron cookware.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, I did. And it came about because I visited an antique mall in upstate New York where one of the sellers had a booth that was just chock full of only cast iron cookware. It's quite beautiful, and I wanted to buy some for myself. Wasn't sure what I should get or how much I should spend on it, so that got me started, and that led me to a couple of the organizations that are, you know, devoted to collecting cast iron cookware. There's one called the Wagner and Griswold Society, and I went online and started talking to people. That led me to Joel, and people are actually quite passionate about the cookware and using it, displaying it in their homes. Joel has 8,000 to 10,000 pieces. There's a fellow out in Washington State who's building an enormous house just to house his collection. So,
not a light collection.
Not a light collection. So there's a really lively, active, knowledgeable, committed community. They share information. They have auctions. They have sales, and it's quite fascinating.
Interesting. Well, you and Joel, you belong to a group called the Kooks.
What? Yeah, the Kooks are the collectors of old kitchen stuff.
Collectors of old kitchen stuff.
And they just had their conference out in Blue Ash, Ohio, along with the ACME, which is the American Coffee Mill Enthusiasts. And so some of the other groups, there's the WAGs that Stacy just mentioned, and also the GNCCA, or GAICA, which is the Griswold and Cast Iron Cookware Association. And also the ice creamers, which also I have an overlap in terms of ice cream cone makers. So each of these areas, some of them are more directly associated with it, and some of them a little more peripherally.
Mm. Well, we're going to jump back a little bit, because you've both mentioned Griswold and Wagner, and let's talk about when kind of, you know, 500, you said around about the 6th century B.C., we have evidence of cast iron cookware from China. And in fact, I saw a picture one time in a we had a presentation for the Culinary Historians of New York, and there was an art collector uptown, and it was a whole display of ancient Chinese cookware and other food-related ware, you know, cups, glasses, plates. And one of the oldest pieces they had, which was not one of the major pieces in the collection, but just really caught my eye, was an old brazier, which you had described before the show began. We were talking about this, or Dutch oven type place. It was a big pot now many of them were made out of bronze or another materials. This happened to be a cast iron one with legs on it, and quite beautiful. But then we come to England, and England started to produce cast iron and then moved on to America. So with throwing out these names like Griswold, Wagner, and of course everybody knows about Lodge, talk about the evolution a little bit of mass production, of the production for the market of cast iron cookware.
Well, normally I tend to think that, first of all, most production sort of follows where the markets are. So the first large amount of production in the U.S. was along the Atlantic seacoast. So you have most of the major groups there. Then what you have is you're talking about Saugus in about 1620 and its sister foundry, Braintree, up in Massachusetts. But you also have Barstow in Rhode Island. You'll have John Savory down in initially perhaps in New York, but then down also in Philadelphia, different members of the family, it seems. Then you have the move slightly inland to the Troy and Albany area, which was a major center of stove production. And the third generation was out along the Great Lakes and down the Ohio River. So you have this movement progressively west, and the easiest form of transportation was, of course, up until the railroads started to go cross country, the easiest form of transportation was by boat. So the initial production is almost like small-scale production done initially by individuals, frequently stove companies, who sometimes made the stuff as go-withs. Hmm. So the cookware was as a go-with to help an incentive to buy the stove, and sometimes was given away free. But by the time you get to some of the major companies like Griswold, Griswold had a special relation with the stove companies. Some of the other company, like Noyes and Nutter, starting to produce fairly complicated pieces like teapots, which had hollow spouts, which were difficult to produce. So when they were starting to produce it, even though they made stoves, they started to make the hollowware for the other companies, and that led the way to specialist companies that would then just make hollowware because they could, A, undercut the prices, but also leave the stove companies to make the stoves, which were going to bring them in a lot more money. And so that's basically what happened with John Savory initially, and then some of their patterns being sold to Griswold later on. So you would have Griswold, W.C. Davis in Cincinnati, Wagner, Piqua buying some of the molds from W.C. Davis and bringing them down to Piqua, and then Chicago Co-op Hardware Foundry, and these things progressively moving west. But that was the general transition of mass marketing.
Well, as a collector, which companies, is it the piece that's more valuable, the more unique the piece, or is it the maker, the company?
Different people focus on different things. And so, for me, I focus on the piece. I'm looking for weird, and I've always done that. I really never cared what company it was made by.
Something unusual. Everyone's kitchen cabinet.
Right. And the things that make something seldom are either something that was made technologically obsolete, stylistically obsolete, like when you go from the Victorian times to modern, or something that never worked to begin with, which was really wonderful.
But do you stick primarily with cookware?
I stick only with cookware.
Only with cookware.
Mm-hmm. Cast iron cookware. I like to know the peripheral, because in order to walk a straight line, you have to know the surrounding terrain.
That's very good, yes.
But other people, like Griswold, made a very large variety of things, and their quality was excellent. But then again, most of the qualities of the early turn of the century, whether it was Lodge or Wagner or Piqua, were all extremely high grade. So basically, just look for things that are very finely cast. Get an old number three skillet of practically any of the companies that's really, really smooth, almost lickably smooth. It looks like iron cream when it's cleaned and everything. And use that as a template for all the other stuff that you're going to get.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, you've brought with you a couple of very unusual pieces. If we could quickly describe that for our listeners, they can't see it, but let's pick that most unusual looking piece there on the end. Can we describe that? Looks a little bit like the nozzle on a hose. Then again, I'm not sure what else it looks like, but it's in two pieces, and you take it from there.
Okie doke. Basically, cast iron is used for three purposes, just to put it in a conceptual framework, which I like to do. It's either used to put heat into something, which is most of our cooking vessels. It's used for pressure, which is another piece we'll talk about later maybe. Or it's used, and people don't think about it, to take heat out of something, because if you can put heat in through iron, you can also remove heat by iron. And so what you would do is you would have cold iron, and you would pour a liquid. And in one large use of it was for what was called clear toy molds, which were Victorian lollipops. Now, from primitive times up to the Victorian era, society was held together what I call intersubjectively. It was held together by meanings and values and those kinds of images. After, in the modern period, we're held together by structure and function. So we're not as much concerned with what the symbolic things are, what images are. But in the Victorian times, they certainly were. And so they had probably several hundred different kinds of things, of seals balancing balls on their nose or patriotic things. And this one here is, strangely enough, a religious thing, which is an image of Christ on the cross.
Now, this is a two-piece heavy cast iron object. It's probably not more than, 5 inches?
Yeah, five inches long, and you could hold it in your fist.
It looks almost like a pipe that's been split the long way, and each side of the pipe has an impression on the inside.
Good, yeah.
And you would hold them together to make the complete pipe, and that's what you would pour.
Yeah, you would turn this upside down, and you would pour your...
It would be cold, or...
It would be cold, and you might even put it in ice, and you would then pour your barleycorn sugar... which you had gotten from reducing the carbohydrate of the barley into a sugar, and then you would put a lollipop thing. So the lollipop sugar would freeze in it. You could possibly also put a candle in it, as was suggested by...
Who knows? We don't know, though. Do
but
we?
To think of Lollipop something where good. You would have a lickable crucifix is kind of strange.
It is a little weird.
It is weird.
Well, we have some more unusual items to talk about, too, as soon as we come back from the break, and we will also talk about a couple of recipes.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to The Main Course Sundays at 12 p.m. with hosts Patrick Martins and Katie Kiefer. They examine issues from the interconnected worlds of agriculture, cuisine, and sustainability. They sit down with key players in the chain from producer to consumer, farmers, distributors, chefs, activists, and journalists. The Main Course explores every important component of the eating experience, how the farmers raise their product, the distribution channels that move the product, how the chefs prepare it, and how ethics and policy affect everyone involved. Again, that's The Main Course, Sundays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
We are back on A Taste of the Past with Joel Schiff, a collector and quite a raconteur and also a historian specializing in cast iron cookware. And Stacy Harwood, who is a writer and a poet, and I failed to mention that she also writes the Critics Pick and Eat This Now columns for Time Out New York, and has written an article that will be coming out soon with on Savour about collectors of cast iron pieces. And Stacy, you had some interesting points to come up when you visited Joel's collection at his apartment here in New York City.
Yes, Joel was talking earlier about one of the kinds of pieces that interest him are those that were unsuccessful when they were first produced because they were of limited utility. And he showed me a few of these, and I was struck by, well, they may not have worked back then when you had 12 mouths to feed
a family of 10, right?
But a muffin tin that only has 3 muffins at a time seemed to me to be something that I would really love to have in my tiny New York City apartment, and that a single person would really like right now.
That's right.
And I wonder, it would be great if some of those things were brought back. They were quite small and
how many muffin tins today, you know, get burned up on one half because you're only making maybe 4 or 6 muffins.
That's right.
You know, who needs 12?
That's right. That's right.
Oh, that's interesting some of these old pieces. Before the break, Joel, you were describing that lollipop maker, which I'm still not sure about that one. but I don't know if I could bring myself to lick that image, but
let me make one comment about the 3-cup mold. This belongs to a category I call quintessentially male, which is especially things made by men, mostly men, no doubt, engineers, who make things when they have no clue whatsoever as to how a woman cooked. And so here you have a coal or wood stove, which once you start it, you can't turn it off. It's not like gas or kerosene or acetylene or some of the other things that were around at that later on. Once you start it, you have to use up whatever kind of fuel you have. And so to make something that only has 3 muffins, or five is absolutely dumb. So it took
not to mention it's not good luck. It's an odd number.
So one company, Waterman, started out with 3-cup molds, and it took him only a year to realize he should go to 6, and within the next year he had gone to the 11 or 12.
Right, right.
But there's this learning curve, even for men, there's a learning curve.
Well, you brought with you another unusual-looking piece and talk about molds, and it is kind of a mold, but looks like an old tortilla press or something, but it's tiny. It's only about 3 inches across. What do you think this, and it does it, do you know where it came from and who made it or anything? You
haven't a clue. I would like it to have come from Maryland because this thing is about, like Linda said, 3 inches across. It's about an inch thick, and then it has another round foot on it that's about 2 inches across. It has tiny little handles that are about the size of your thumb, and they're about just that long. And they curve upwards on one side and down on the other. And not only that, it's painted. So clearly this would not seem to be a piece of cookware for putting heat into something, because not only does it have this extra ring, which is about a half an inch high, that keeps it away from the heat, but the handles are too short and would heat up too quickly. The extra side, the way they come up, was for pressure. And if you open it up, it has a hollow area about, you would have a small hamburger size.
Teeny hamburger.
Yes, teeny hamburger.
Slider.
Yeah, slider, right.
It's about the size of a slider. And my projection is that this was for commercial production of crab cakes or fish cakes, so that you would have a bunch of these in some kind of a holder that would make use of the bottom of the foot of the thing. And then when you put your crab cake, you could then come down on the
weight
top of
it would
and press it together with your fingers.
Give it that nice, round, even, perfect circle.
And if you needed to, you could pick it up and dump it out and go for the next thing. So this belongs to a category of things that were used for pressure rather than heat. Mm-hmm. And they included the Springerly or press molds that had images on them, tortilla presses we're maybe more familiar with right now, and also some of the Easter eggs in which you just wouldn't have like some of the other cake molds, the rabbit and the lamb and so forth, but you'd use them for crushed walnuts or coconut or whatever, which you would then enrobe. But you would press against them to get the Easter egg form. And those would come out of, let's say, the Thomas Mills and Brother catalog. You could buy them in the confectionery things. So these things are used for pressure, not heat or removal of heat.
Well, now, Stacy brought up a good point earlier in the show. For those who go to antique shows, fairs and things, they pick up a piece of cast iron. You know, how do they know what it is, especially if it's just marked? It doesn't have a maker mark on the bottom. It just says made in the USA. What does this tell us about the piece?
Generally, something that has made in USA, you may have some things that say, like the Griswold from a very early time will say Erie, PA, USA. But if it says made in USA, that's typically a fairly late mark. I think around 1924, there was a law that was passed because some countries were marketing materials, let's say, coming in from Japan, which would be listed as Nippon, and nobody knew where that was coming from, and that was considered unfair trade practice at the time. So a law was passed that had to indicate, you know, where the materials came from. Not that that would make any difference at all today.
But we could place it any time after 1924.
Yes,
oh,
and
good.
The early things also, if you look at a piece of cast iron, if you see a casting mark, which is a line along the bottom, or sometimes moved up to the rim for easier grinding and so forth, that would indicate that it was definitely an earlier piece. And even earlier than that would be what we call a sprue, which would be a round casting mark, not a line. And those would be something from anywhere from the 1600s up to about, let's say, 1720. Mm-hmm. These things change in about 100-year increments.
Oh, well, glad they don't, you know, rush into things, right? Well, as I had mentioned at the top of the show, cast iron cooking seems to have undergone a bit of a renaissance, and I don't know about anyone else, but I've always loved my cast iron skillet, and there's nothing quite like it. And I think one of the modern touches, too, that brought people back into it were the cast iron grill pans. They loved to barbecue, they loved to grill, but of course inside of an apartment or a home, you couldn't, but you could heat up this cast iron pan to unusual temperatures and grill something. And then, of course, we see pictures of the cornbread molds and things like that. But are there any about cooking in cast iron? Actually, they say it's good for people with iron deficiencies because some of that iron does leach out of it, right?
That's right.
But what about recipes? What are some of the recipes that have endured that are best made in cast iron?
Well, because it is such a good retainer of heat and will stay hot for a long time, people often use it for braising. And also people will talk about hauling out their chicken fryer a couple of times a year. Because again, it will maintain a steady heat for a long time and you can fry up your chicken. So those are things that are typically used, you know, cast iron is used for. I use mine for braising. I make, you know, braised lamb shanks and it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's great because you can sear them on top of the stove and then
stick it in the oven and then you can bring it to the table, and it's great.
Yeah, that's right. Serve it all, too. Yeah. Now, you were going to bring a treat for me today, you didn't.
So, yeah, speaking of New York City apartments in 85-degree weather, I did not want to turn on my oven this morning.
I can't blame you. But you have a recipe that you make for in a cast iron mold for old corn pone, right?
Yes, that's right. And I did buy a corn stick mold. It's a very common one, number 273. And it does have the impressions that make each piece look like an ear of corn. And the recipe I have is very simple. I copied it from an advertising pamphlet. It calls for 1 cup of cornmeal.
Did you date that pamphlet at all? Was it?
I think it was 50s, 40s, around then, just based on the illustrations. 1 cup of cornmeal, 3 teaspoons baking powder, 1/2 cup of flour, 1 egg, 1/2 cup of milk, 3 tablespoons of sugar, so it's not a sweet, and 1 tablespoon of oil. Mix it all together, 375, 15 minutes.
In the mold, but you have to have the mold.
You have to have the mold, and I just brushed mine lightly with some neutral oil, and the cast iron gives it a really nice crust.
Crispy.
Yes, it's a really nice tactile experience.
Absolutely.
Eating something that's been baked in a cast iron.
Yeah, my father was from the South, my mother was not, and it was her job to have to learn to make a proper cornbread in the old cast iron skillet, and I think it took many years for that to ever be accomplished, but boy, it was good.
And you see the skillets with the dividers make the pieces uniform.
Right. Well, and talking about these old skillets and molds and things, when we go and we find some old in an antique shop, sometimes thrown in the corner will be a pile of old cookware. Some of it looks a little skeptical because it is so rusty and over the edge. Is it possible to breathe new life into some of those rusty old kettles or
skillets
or
pots and pans?
Nobody should be afraid of light rust, grease, and paint. What you want to look for are things that can't be fixed by ordinary cleaning and polishing. So you don't want to get things that are cracked, broken, heavy corrosion, scale, things like that. Warps, if they're severely warped, will make it so that the heating surface is uneven. But other than that, there are several methods. One is if you happen to have a self-cleaning oven, the easiest thing to do is put on some oven off, which actually is lye. By the way, it's the same thing as Nair that people use.
On their skin, yes.
So, and you put that on there, and you can either leave the oven off material, the lye, in the bag for a few hours, and then put it through a self-cleaning cycle, and that'll do it.
Would you wipe the lye off first before you put it in the self-cleaning?
No, because essentially you're also using the same kind of oven off for the oven itself.
Right.
Or you can make up a lye bath, in which case you would get some lye, which is hard to get now.
I think we'll stick with the oven off. That's mostly available to people, right?
Fine. It's a little bit more expensive than getting the batch stuff. The other thing that's recently come down the pike is the D-electro, in which case you're taking off the outer one molecule and anything that happens to be attached to it. And this works for everything except the enameled pieces, which is enamel. We call it enamel. It's actually sintered glass. It's
yeah, that's something
glass.
We didn't have a chance to talk about. The companies like Le Creuset and of course they go back even further than that. The companies that then put a colored finish on an enamel, as you said, we say enameled finish makes it look like a pretty serving piece. I like the old solid black cast iron myself.
My prejudice also.
Yeah. Well, we have so much more we could talk about. I'm sorry that our time is up. We'll just have to do another show. Well, thank you so much, Joel Schiff and Stacy Harwood. Again, this has been Linda Palacio for A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. The USDA has introduced the MyPlate icon. I'm sure you've all seen that in the news, replacing the food pyramid that was in use for 19 years. This colorful icon contains portions of fruits, vegetables, grains, protein, and a little side dish of dairy. It can be viewed at www.choosemyplate.gov. It does look like a plate. It's divided into four quadrants. They are surprisingly similarly sized. Vegetables, fruits, proteins, grains. The veg are definitely a little bit larger than the other groups, but protein was really big. I was surprised. I thought we were supposed to eat less meat. Each component of the plate can be clicked on for a drop-down menu that explains portion size, healthy choices, nutritional information, etc. It offers significantly more information to consumers, but it is a little bit more complicated to use. We'll see if people actually look at it. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Check out a small clip of Chef Smarty Pants, a.k.a. Erica Wides, talking about radishes on her show, Why We Cook.
Those supermarket radishes were like that. They were all heat and no flavor and woody and tough, and they were always kind of beat up and buggy looking, and they looked like crap. I don't understand why they were sold. They were in that plastic bag all sealed up for like 6 months. Why buy them? We always put them into our salad growing up, and I would just pick them out. And my mom still buys them. She still buys those bags. To me, those bags of radishes are like the ultimate symbol of industrial produce. They're grown for size and for color, but they taste like balls of wood dipped in nail polish remover. I don't understand why people would eat them. So I never understood the appeal of the radish until...
Want to hear more? Tune in live to Why We Cook every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m., where you can find all the old shows on our archives. Also, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.